Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's Friday the 13th of October 2017. I want to discuss today a statement made by Ludwig Wittgenstein. And this is the statement. Nothing is more difficult than not deceiving oneself. So, intuitively, what's our first take on this? What's our first feeling about it? Well, I find myself saying, oh yeah, he's right. Even though I don't have an analysis as yet of what self-deception might be, what difficulty might be, of how one might appraise whether one is deceiving oneself or not. This issue plugs into the related issue of authenticity. Is it possible for us to be authentic? Heidegger, for instance, who made quite a bit of the notion of authenticity, said that most of us are inauthentic and that it's almost impossible not to be authentic. And probably in a different vocabulary, he was expressing the same insight that Wittgenstein expressed. For yoga people, we have the notion found in Patanjali of satya, of a kind of truth-telling with oneself, an encounter of the suchness of oneself, of the actuality of oneself, of one's inner landscape. And certainly in Patanjali, it's taken to be a possibility. And of course, in Wittgenstein's uttering, we still say that it's a possibility. Nothing is more difficult than not deceiving oneself. But that implies that there is at least a very small chance of setting aside self-deception. So what is it to deceive oneself? How might one deceive oneself? Why would you say to a friend, I think you're deceiving yourself? What scenario would cause us to utter that? Now that sounds like a very natural utterance. It sounds like something that could just occur in natural discourse. Particularly amongst people who are intimate with each other and make use of a sort of a confessional mode in their friendships and so forth. So what's going on when we say this? You are deceiving yourself. Well, what would be going on when you said to yourself, or you said to a friend, I think I deceived myself? Now, I draw attention to how natural these articulations sound. They don't have that clunky feel about them that some philosophical thought experiments can have. It just sounds very natural. So what goes on? Now, an instructive scenario might go something like this. You have a friend who's just come out of a relationship, an intense romantic relationship, shall we say, and found the experience of coming out of the relationship rather like waking up out of a dream. At first they're full of the other, and the other is full of them, and there's an intoxication, and everything has this rosy glow to it, and this person is truly wonderful. And then perhaps little by little you discover that you're being manipulated, or that the person isn't the paragon of virtue that you thought they were. And you fall out of love. Maybe there's some kind of incident that reveals an ugly side to the beloved's personality, and you can't take it. And you realise there's a disjunct, or what do they call it, a cognitive dissonance between what you thought this person was like and what this new behaviour has revealed about them. Now, these situations are the stuff of soap operas and TV dramas and films and so forth, and novels and the rest of it. Tales of disillusionment. And it, again, this is something that has a ring of truth about it, that doesn't sound too unfamiliar or implausible. It's a good thought experiment. Now, isn't that a case of self-deception? So what happens when you get into that intoxication of love that prevents you from seeing everything about somebody? Well, okay, the person in question, this candidate beloved, may well have concealed their true nature. They were on their best behaviour. I mean, how often does this happen in human life? People are on their best behaviour, they strive to impress. They present a facade that covers up a darker interior. I've come across this recently, actually reading the CVs of some people who've set up an organisation, and they sound great on paper, these people. But I happen to know that they're, in real life, they're not as competent as they appear from the CV. And so forth. And not as endowed with probity and so forth as the CV appears. But there's nothing untrue in the CV. It's just selective. It's just this thing of putting on your best face or being on your best behaviour. So there's concealment and revelation in all human presentation of self, in all human relationship, which is based on the idea of people discovering each other, becoming intimate with each other. Now, in the case of that disillusionment, when you fall out of love because the bubble, as it were, bursts, the intoxication wears off, the hangover part of romance. And I think if you're fairly astute, you realise you've been projecting a wish onto the other. The other has behaved in such a way that they can actually act as a screen, which enables all your deepest wishes of an ideal other to find a suitable screen to take on the projection. So if you're astute in these situations, you start to realise the deep nature of wish and desire, and how profound the effect of deep wish and deep desire, and deep desire to be relieved of our inherent dissatisfaction. How powerful that is. We realise how powerful that is. How it can change our whole picture of reality, even if it's just a small portion of reality, the nature of another. Now, it's a psychoanalytic notion, the notion of projection, and Wittgenstein was deeply anti-psychoanalysis. He thought that Freud's stories were in fact just so stories. And he points out that we can interpret dreams coherently and in a way that fits in lots and lots of different ways. And that in itself undermines the claims to scientific rigour of Freudian psychoanalysis. And one suspects that Wittgenstein also had this personal stake in slagging off psychoanalysis because of the fact that his sister had in fact been analysed by Freud. Heidegger, similarly, for slightly different reasons, was anti-psychoanalysis. And I think for Heidegger, the notion of the unconscious didn't make very much sense. And he wanted to replace psychoanalysis with Dasein analysis. And he did see that there were psychotherapeutic possibilities in an analysis of the immediate field of phenomenological field of Dasein. And in fact did work with a number of Swiss psychiatrists on elaborating this in the period after World War II, when the American authorities had forbidden him to teach in the German universities on account of his Nazi past. So two of the big thinkers of the 20th century, both sniffy about psychoanalysis. So both of those would probably be a bit sniffy about this talk of projection. Though it doesn't necessarily follow that because we're talking about projection and the power of desire to colour our perceptions. It doesn't mean to say that we are card-carrying Freudians. It might be that there is simply a mechanism that when consciousness tries to reflect on its own contents, to put it crudely, that there is just an inherent impossibility of clarity. We can feel clear, but that doesn't mean to say that we are clear. We can feel that there's no interference, doesn't mean to say there is no interference. And I suppose another explanation, and I think Wittgenstein might be thinking along these lines, given that he had a very deep and strong ethical impulse. One time when Wittgenstein was agonising about some problem in logic, pacing up and down in Russell's rooms in Cambridge, and Russell said to him, what are you thinking about, logic or your soul? And Wittgenstein turned around and said, both. There was such an equation of truth-seeking with moral worth for Wittgenstein, which was tied up with very, very strong conscience, you know, and wanting to be a good person. And that meant wanting to be as logical as you could possibly be, wanting not to take the easy route in philosophy and settle too early, lay the spade down too early, as Nietzsche might have put it. But this is a matter of conscience. This is a philosophical superego, tied in with a self-image, and a self-image that's strongly under scrutiny in the manner outlined by St. Augustine. So, Wittgenstein was actually very strongly inclined in this direction. Wanted to put himself right, wanted to be a good person, was a kind of a self-cultivator, but thought that it was very difficult, and experienced quite a lot of despair as a result of this. So what's at issue here is ego, or self-image. Not necessarily the image projected on the world, but the sense of oneself to oneself, under the light of a moral category, or set of categories. This is what this really mattered to him. And so not deceiving oneself here is taking on the pain of seeing moral shortcomings, of not pretending they're not there, of not excusing them, in order to avoid the pain of recognition that you are not the worthy being you would like to be. And this happens to people with this very, very strong kind of conscience. And of course, in Wittgenstein's case, I said it's a philosophical conscience, which would cause him to agonise whether he really elucidated the logic of a particular conundrum sufficiently, whether he'd worked hard enough on it, whether he'd suffered enough, worked enough, sweated enough to get to the bottom of it. And I think he means something along these lines. So if you look at it like that, it's very, very difficult to be authentic. Human beings have a propensity to bullshit, and to bullshit themselves, for reasons which boil down to avoiding moral pain. And now the conundrum arises, isn't it possible to bullshit oneself to the extent that one believes one is being authentic, one believes one is being truthful, one believes one is employing satya, when in fact, you know, when the impulse to conceal from yourself shortcomings, or to perhaps to realise desire through projection, that those mechanisms are invisible to oneself. They're so powerful. And that the way out of that impasse is just to say to yourself, I am genuinely being authentic, to persuade yourself that you are being authentic. So the notion of authenticity is almost immediately laden and interwoven with inauthenticity, with bullshitting oneself. And it's these kind of conundrums which I think Wittgenstein is alert to also. Given these considerations, is Wittgenstein right? Now we've had a little bit of a closer look at what might be going on here. Well, yeah, obviously. We believe our own bullshit. And then we bullshit ourselves that we're not falling for believing our own bullshit. And we bullshit ourselves about that. In a regress, perhaps. But of course, if it was like that, as I've just put it, that would mean that it was completely impossible to not deceive oneself. But Wittgenstein is saying, nothing is more difficult. But that doesn't mean impossible. More difficult doesn't mean impossible. So where would the possibility come? What would make that 1% possibility of seeing with great clarity the truth of self, without projection, without the influence of wish and desire, without fear of losing one's self-image to oneself, and consequently one's idea of one's moral worth, what would that entail? According to Patanjali, reading between the lines just a little, it is possible. And satya is given as a kind of moral precept by Patanjali. Even though I think what he's getting at really is a concrete practice, even though he doesn't say all that much more about it. People construe it as meaning truth telling, you know, not telling lies, not bearing false witness. And it's a common commandment in most religious, ethical injunctions. But I think the guy is so practically minded and so intent on turning this inward that this is actually alluding to a practice, to an attempt to overcome the difficulty of not deceiving oneself. And I think this could take on at least two initial forms. And the first one would be recognising desire and the power of desire and the formative creative power of desire as it exerts itself on the shape and content of our consciousness. It is possible to stand at a vantage point within one's microcosm, such that one can see this stuff acting. You can see the projection going on. You can see how desire wants you to deny a certain perception and affirm another. Or even invent something. Desire is inventive. We can see this about ourselves and we can admit it. Now, I'm not saying this is easy, even though I don't think it's impossible. Actually, I do think it's easy in some ways. But very elusive. This is the thing, it's very elusive. So that's one way. And the other possibility is again that which has come out of our consideration of Wittgenstein. And that's the possibility of seeing the play of our own self-image and of our own self-image in the light of some interiorised notions of the good or the perfection or proper character or what it is to be a worthy person. In other words, we can see the play of self-image and conscience. Again, there is a vantage point possible from which one can see this stuff acting just as plain as the light of day. So that's another way in which we might begin to desist from deceiving ourselves by seeing these mechanisms. Of course, you could argue that even within that creation of this other vantage point and so forth, that there's still an inauthenticity or a deceptiveness acting. I mean, how would you argue this? Well, you'd say you're still in the position of finding what you seek. You're setting up the target, as it were. You're creating the thing that you'll find before you find it, and then, of course, of necessity, finding it. Confirmation bias, that kind of stuff. It seems to me that there is a possibility of this vantage point, but it does come out of a particular practice, again, a practice of inquiry. And it comes out of being very quiet inside, of allowing the settling to happen so that one day when it's ready, the quietness comes about. And if you consider it, you'll see that quietness exits the terrain of possibility of confirmation bias or of setting the thing up to get what you want, of desire disguising its action, projection disguising its action. Because in the silence, there's no room for those things. The thing about them is that they're noisy. So the vantage point of Satya, the place where this remote possibility of not deceiving oneself can actualise, is the quiet place. And it's the quietness, in as much as it defeats all noise, which forces projection, desire, wish, self-image, conscience, all to be taken out of the scenario. Exit stage left. But even if that analysis is incorrect, and we are in fact in an infinite regress of being inauthentic about our attempts to be authentic forever and ever and ever, that inauthenticity is all that we've got, that self-deception is all that we've got, I would say no matter, and that the attempt at Satya through silence, through allowing one's apparatus of mentation and emotion to subside, is still worth it. It's a value in its own right, and that it's worth experimenting with it just for the sake of what it is, of what it feels like. And we don't have to take our dilemmas and considerations onto the terrain of some metaphysical pursuit of certainty about what it is that we perceive, whether inwardly or outwardly. We can actually leave that on one side, because the thing is valuable in itself. So, those kind of considerations lead one to say such things as, well, just don't worry about whether you're inauthentic or authentic, but do have a go at finding out what this truthfulness about self is like. Explore that terrain, see what you discover, and there's great value in that. And I'm just saying that, I'm just recommending it. Just try it. Now, I'm pretty sure that some people who argue that inauthenticity will never escape us, then take that as a kind of anything goes scenario. And one ends up wishing that they would at least have a go. And if we live in an era of post-truth, which would be the concomitant of that stance that, well, inauthenticity is inescapable, therefore I'll just lie through my teeth all the time because everything's rhetoric anyway. This is just a state of affairs in which human beings will not flourish. And recently I've been on the receiving end of that kind of stuff. And you probably all know about this kind of thing, whereby somebody can seem fantastically plausible. Great presentation skills, but no sense of just that ordinary adequation, this notion of truth. No attempt to struggle with self on that terrain of truthfulness, just to see what it's like, regardless of any metaphysical possibilities and so forth. And I just don't see how the human species is going to flourish, and how human individuals are going to flourish, and have lives of joy and intensity and relatedness and love, if this project of overcoming self-deceit isn't at least engaged with, even regardless of what its ultimate possibilities might be. I don't want to live in a world ruled by sophists and people who can't get beyond rhetoric into some kind of pure inquiry. Anyway, I don't mean that morally or ethically, I'm talking practically about how are we going to live. That old Socratic question just keeps popping up: how is life to be lived? And it's a question that impacts on individuals and on collectivities. Well, with that, as I approach the Jordan's Mill Bridge, I'll leave you. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it.